Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. Our story this week about Robert Johnson. I don't know about you, but it really got my blood boiling. Robert is from the South Side, and he's been in prison now for nearly 30 years. He's essentially serving a life sentence for a murder that almost everybody knows he did not commit.
It doesn't take much at all to wrongly convict someone, especially in Cook County.
This is investigative journalist Allison Flowers. She co-authored an investigation in 2020 with the Invisible Institute that looked at all the things that went wrong in Robert Johnson's case.
The number one reason that people are wrongly convicted is false testimony. Someone up there lying on the stand. That could be a jailhouse informant. That could be a co-defendant in your case who got a deal on their own. Or it could be just with someone that you have a beef with, or someone who's just mistaken. Mm. And they're getting it wrong on the stand and they're testifying against you. That's really the number one reason.
Wow. At Robert's trial back in 1997, his co-defendants blamed him for the murder of Eddie Binion. Since then, they have recanted their testimonies.
The second top reason for wrongful convictions in this country is official misconduct, and usually police misconduct. Coercing statements, suggestive photo arrays and lineups, or unfortunately here in Chicago, our vast history of police torture.
The detective who arrested Robert was James O'Brien, and he came up under somebody whose name you've probably heard of before, John Burge, the notorious and disgraced Chicago police detective who was responsible for torturing dozens of suspects in order to get false confessions. The Invisible Institute connected O'Brien, a lead detective on Robert's case, to over 50 allegations of physical abuse, torture, coercion, and manipulating evidence, almost all of them against young Black and brown men. And there are other reasons why it seems Robert was wrongfully convicted nearly 30 years ago, including the fact that no physical evidence was presented against Robert at his trial. In our last episode, we heard all about the many reasons why it is so very difficult to overturn a wrongful conviction, even when all the signs point to innocence. Today, Allison is going to help us take a look at the other side of that coin. What has to go right? Allison, welcome to Curious City.
Thank you for having me.
We're here to talk about some of the primary elements that a person on the inside needs in order to prove their innocence and be exonerated. You have talked and written about three of those top things. Tell me what those are.
When it comes to clearing your name and you're inside prison, you have to consider that you have really limited access to the outside world. And so it's hard to look up anything. It's hard to get in touch with people. You have to write letters. You know, it's just very hard to advocate for yourself inside prison. And so the first thing that you need is an advocate actually on the outside to help you, mm-hmm. to do the facilitating, to be contacting people, to kind of be the project manager of your wrongful conviction.
And your proxy in
right,
some ways.
Exactly. Yeah. The second thing is you need a journalist to help you, media attention, So you need someone to write about your case and potentially investigate your case as well. And you also need a lawyer to take that new evidence to court on your behalf. Sometimes the lawyers do the investigating as well, and then they'll, you know, loop in the media to cover the case. So the lawyers and the journalists sometimes works alongside each other in pursuing the truth. But those are the three things that you need. And it's all centered around the goal of finding new evidence. And the new evidence that you need to find actually needs to do two things. One, it needs to not have been available at the original trial. And two, it needs to have made a difference in the outcome of the case. So maybe there's a new piece of information, but it's not significant enough to have led to a not guilty verdict. And so you have to find new evidence that wasn't available originally, but would have made a difference in the original case.
Got it.
So this is what we call the three-legged stool of what can give a wrongful conviction case a better chance of gaining freedom.
Mm-hmm. And for you as the journalist leg of this stool, do you normally end up getting the case first and then going to a lawyer? Does a lawyer normally end up coming to you? Like
It's gone both ways. So people who are incarcerated write to me directly, and they don't always, the case doesn't always come from an advocate or a family member. Sometimes lawyers bring cases to me. Sometimes after I'm done with an investigation and I've published about it, I can bring that to the attention of a lawyer and say, you know, this is a strong case. Or sometimes lawyers see the coverage about the case or find the story and are compelled by it and want to move forward and represent the person. So it can go in all sorts of different directions. So I'll give an example of a case. Jennifer Delpreet, she was a daycare worker at a home daycare where there were no other adults at the time, and a child, baby, fell ill under her care. She, you know, did what she could, performed CPR and called for help and all the things. The baby died a year later, and she was charged with the baby's murder under a shaken baby syndrome diagnosis. Of course, what wasn't known at the time was sort of the earlier medical warning signs in the infant that was documented elsewhere. In that case, she actually had lawyers, and she did also have an advocate, someone who had called me and said, this is the case that keeps me up at night. And so with that, we decided to move forward and investigate her case. She was released from prison and just recently got her certificate of innocence. But it really wasn't until, you know, all three pieces came together for her, the advocate, the lawyers, and the media attention, the journalists, that her case was able to move forward because of that additional evidence that the journalists were able to find.
Mm-hmm. How have you kind of evolved this as a craft that you do?
Well, I always respond to the letters that I get. I have questions that I ask up front. It's very useful to know, was there physical evidence in your case? Did you confess? Not that if you did, I'll hold it against you, but was it a credible confession? What were the circumstances of that confession? Were you held for an extended period of time? Were you coerced? Were you abused? Who were the officers in your case? That has become a more important question to ask, especially in the city of Chicago, because we can look up their records and know to some degree if they've done this to other people. Was there an alternative suspect? Was there chatter about who else might have done this? And was there a compelling alibi? I need to know what someone's alibi was in order to vet that as well. So those are the questions that I ask in a questionnaire. I send it back. And unfortunately, sometimes I can look at a case and think, I totally believe this person is innocent, but there's no way to prove it because all the witnesses are gone. Or maybe the witnesses are very fixed in what they think happened, or are too afraid to come forward. That's a big one. Oftentimes, an entire neighborhood, an entire community can know that someone didn't do it, but they're too afraid of the actual perpetrator, right?
Which is a case in our last episode.
Robert Johnson. In Robert Johnson's case, everybody knew that Robert didn't do it. But so many people were afraid of coming forward and saying, this is the person who did do it, or this person told me that they did it. That was part of the delay in Robert Johnson's case. And it just so happened that the, you know, the actual killer died in 2018, allowing people to come forward without fear. So that can be a huge barrier to moving a wrongful conviction case forward.
Mm-hmm. I just want to comment that, you know, you watch fictional television and so much of what you've described just now is what is portrayed as like a lawyer's process, right? And it's so rare, I think, that, you know, you see the depiction of the journalist as the investigator as well, right? As an integral component of a criminal case and, you know, an exoneration case. Sounds like it's really valuable for the person.
You know, I often wish I were a lawyer because when I come up with this new evidence, it's like, well, great. Who's going to take this to court? You know?
Like there's a next step here that needs to happen that I am not authorized.
Right.
To
and
take.
Fortunately, you know, I have some credibility and I can send the investigative story to others and say, hey, this is a strong case. But ultimately, I can't take it to court myself as much as I would like to.
I want to get to the other side of the exoneration. I read in some of your writing that being exonerated is less like a conclusion and more like just one step in a very long process. Some might even call it a really messed up commencement of sorts. Talk about the challenges, even if you're proven not guilty, to re-entering society.
Right. Well, you know, there's still that kind of stain on your record. You can't, especially now with Google searches, you know, the fact that you were convicted of the crime, that never goes away, even with expungement, even with certificates of innocence, which not everybody gets, sometimes for very technical reasons of availability of evidence and that type of thing. But, you know, it's hard to reenter society and look for a job when there's the box and it asks you, were you ever convicted of a crime? Well, it's like, well, yes, I was, but I didn't do it. And then I was exonerated. Like that doesn't fit in the box. Right. Mm-mm. And so it can be extremely difficult for people to get employment, or there's also like just the mindset or the suspicion, like, well, you must have done something to put yourself in that position, right? There's sort of like that judgment behind it. You know, also, not all states offer compensation to people who are wrongly convicted. And even if you do get it, it's not a quick process. One woman's case who I investigated and she was set free, it took her another 10 years before she got her certificate of innocence. And she was finally granted that recently. Here in Illinois, you know, depending on how long you were behind bars, you know, the maximum that you'll get is a little bit under $200,000. So,
and that's for like 14 plus years.
Absolutely. And so like if you were behind bars for more than for about 5 years, it's 85,000. For 5 to 14 years, I think it's like 170,000. And 14 plus years is like $199,000. Mm-hmm. So it's just not a lot of money to account for all of that time. And it really doesn't stretch far. And you can be innocent, but your case maybe isn't suited for like a civil lawsuit that would result in millions of dollars. I think that's the other misconception, is that people think, oh, well, once you're released, you're going to be so rich because you're going to get this multi-million dollar lawsuit. And that is that's earned by the few.
You have to pay for that lawyer, right? You have to, you know, depending on when you get your compensation, if you do, you may not be able to do that or get a job or get that income. Common sense might tell a person that this would be an automatic process. It would be swift, and that it would be accessible. The exoneration has happened. Let's get that compensation going. Tell me about some of the reasons and situations in which that's not the case.
So what happens is some people are released from prison and their convictions are overturned, and maybe the state's not going to retry them, but they're not going to say that they're innocent. So when you're in that process of pursuing compensation, you actually then have to reprove your innocence again through a separate process called the Certificate of Innocence process.
Okay.
And so you got to go through all the evidence again. It seems nonsensical to have to go through that again because it's like, you know, we just did this. And it's also a process that can drag on and on, sometimes as long as a decade. But, you know, from the state's perspective, they're saying we don't have enough evidence to pursue another trial, but we don't think you're innocent. But also, even when they know they're wrong, they don't say they're wrong because they don't want to open themselves up to bigger lawsuits, right? So that can be an additional insult to injury in this whole process, is when, you know, it's so clear that someone is innocent, like Robert Johnson. It's so clear that Robert Johnson is innocent, so clear that the state offered him a deal to walk before his evidentiary hearing began. And he said, no, I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do. And I just have to say that that's something that only an innocent person would do. A guilty person might take the deal, right? An innocent person might take the deal too, but only an innocent person would reject it. Only an innocent person would reject it.
In the reporting that was done for Robert Johnson's story, there was a recording of his cousin talking about an apology and all of the implications that that would have if, you know, the state of Illinois were to say, we were wrong, I'm sorry, oops. And I wonder if you can talk about that component and what it would mean for the state and officials to do something like that, and how that could be a deterrent as well.
So getting that official apology is something that people will, you know, have to wait for, will always be waiting for. It doesn't really come. I have seen judges say after they render their order, you know, I'm sorry that this happened to you. Sometimes you'll hear it uttered from, like, you know, prosecutors in the hallway to family, or, you know, the kind of closed door thing. But getting an official apology, that official apology doesn't come. But you have to remember that there's just humans in the process, and you can appeal to those humans. That's something that Robert Johnson has, you know, reminded us of. He's the one sitting in the courtroom after all this time and watching all the new evidence and the witnesses and everyone coming forward. I brought with me a letter that he recently wrote to me after his hearing. He said, I almost had to pinch myself a couple of times just to make sure I wasn't dreaming. I couldn't believe it. I kept thinking to myself, finally the truth. It took 28 years for me to get to this moment. As I sat there taking everything in, my lawyers, the students, the investigation, you, my family, the witnesses who testified on my behalf, I became overwhelmed with gratitude, humility, and hope. What a feeling. I must say that this experience has had a big effect on me. While I still do not have any faith in the criminal justice system, I do have more faith in people. And I think he says that just so well. Like, you know, wrongful convictions are going to happen. They're terrible. And people do have the power to reverse them, to come forward, to tell the truth. The judge has the power to render the decision to set him free. The prosecution has the power to drop their opposition in the case. There are individual actors. And so I think when you kind of take the system away and you just look at people as decision makers, as humans, things can feel a lot more possible.
Allison Flowers is an investigative journalist and author in Chicago focused on criminal justice. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of Curious City was produced by me and Justin Bull. Mary Hall is our digital producer. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. Special thanks to the Invisible Institute, a journalism nonprofit on the South Side. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and shy. WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.